Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Pearlman. My guest is Lori Rubin. Rubin, who has been blind since birth, is an accomplished mezzo-soprano, author, jewelry maker, and co-founder and artistic director of the Ohana Performing Arts School and Festival in Hawaii. Her career highlights include her solo recital debut at Carnegie Hall and her performances with the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. She performs all over the U.S. and Europe. She recently published a memoir called Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight, published this month by Seven Stories Press. A CD was also released entitled Do You Dream in Color? By Bridge Records. I'm speaking to Lori Rubin by phone from her office in Los Angeles. Lori Rubin, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, despite the fact that you were diagnosed as blind as an infant in Southern California, your parents really wanted you to be treated like a normal child. Tell us about that.
You know what it was? I mean, I had a brother who was 5 years older than me. And you know how the second child is, too. The second child wants to do everything the older child does.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents, you know, they didn't know what was possible for me. And they went through a lot of grieving about, you know, having a child that was different and all that. But I think at the end of the day, what they really wanted was to give me the life that would make me as independent and normal as possible. So they did. The first thing they did was they bought a 1979 Chevy van. It's really funny. I tell people that and they're like, why? And then it's because they wanted to take me on road trips all over the country. All over the state. And they wanted me to experience the world with the senses I did have. So they exposed me to, and unfortunately they exposed me to a bear very early on in my life.
Oh my
goodness.
Camping.
We were in Sequoia and we heard a call of bear. Oh no, there's a bear. I wanted to pet the bear, but you know, my brother crawled under the under the bed. But you know, I don't have that many recollections of those times, but it's just, we, you know, I've always known nature and skiing and all these kinds of things because they just wanted me to grow up knowing what the world was like.
Yeah, and you were game, right? I mean, a lot of kids who have disabilities are kind of timid and shy in my experience, but you were game.
Oh, really?
You were game to do all this stuff.
I wouldn't take no for an answer. I've always been that way. I'm still like that, and I, you know, I'm sure that people are like, oh, that girl Lori, there goes the squeaky wheel again. But that's just been my personality. That, you know, and I remember there was one time I kept a manager, an artist manager, on the phone for 2.5 hours because she was being very nice, but she said, I can't represent you because, you know, this and that about your being a blind person. And I tried to dispel every single argument that she had. And that's just how I've always been. I've never let people get away with any kind of stereotype or misconception or whatnot.
Oh, I think it's great. And it comes out in your book, too. It's just really fascinating. Now you discovered music at a really young age. Tell us how that came about. Was it singing or instruments? How did you start?
Well, I started in music when I was in elementary school. I had this wonderful teacher. I went to a school for the blind from nursery school, actually, and until third grade. And the elementary school I went to, called Francis Blend School for the Blind, they had this wonderful music teacher who was so into classical music, and so she played everything for us from Peter and the Wolf and telling us how all the instruments represented the personalities of these different animals and people, therefore giving each of the instruments different color and aura about them, to showing us each of the instruments in the orchestra so that when we would hold a violin, for example, even if we never became professional violinists, she wanted us to know that when we would go to an orchestra concert, for example, that we would know how each instrument is played. And that was so important for me because I was never a passive listener. I always knew. It wasn't just like listening and of course I loved listening to the radio too, but when I went to a live concert, I was able to picture what each player in the orchestra was doing. And it was great for me because I grew up listening to public radio and being inspired, and whenever they would announce concerts at the Hollywood Bowl, I wanted to go because I just wanted to be around these live musicians. And then as I got older, I was starting to play the piano because my brother did, and my mom kind of insisted that we all play the piano. And my piano teacher just didn't notice any improvement because I wouldn't practice. But eventually, you know, what she did is she said, you know, you're singing along with everything that we're playing, so why don't you take voice lessons? And so my mom decided to just try that out. And sure enough, that was where I was meant to be, is in singing, not in piano.
Yeah, you've got a beautiful voice. And thank God they recognize that. Now, I want to talk about, you talk about this in your book, a huge moment when you first heard Kenny Loggins. And then you eventually met him, and he became one of your mentors.
Yes. Well, when I was about 4 years old, my mother, and it's so funny, it must be when I started remembering things, because I would say 4 years old. My mom was playing him in the car for us all the time. We would, you know, whether it was he'd be taking me to my nursery school or to the market or whatever. So Kenny was always a big part of my musical life. And then there was one time she went to the market, and I used to go with her, but this is the one time I didn't go with her because it was raining. And she came home like the cat that swallowed the canary and said, "Guess who I saw at the market?" And I said, "Who?" And she made me guess a few things, and then she said, "Kenny Loggins." And I was like, "Oh, my gosh." And, you know, so she told him about how I loved his music and how I had so many questions about how he does harmony and all these crazy things. And he said, you know, he was really inspired by the fact that he was reaching young generations, not just people his own age. So he invited us to his concert, and we went backstage. So that also snowballed into a very long-lasting friendship with him and his whole band. And we would go to a lot of his concerts. We would go to Lake Tahoe because we had a condo there. And we'd go to Caesar's Palace, and almost every 6 months or so, it seemed like, he had concerts there. Eventually, we would go water skiing and snow skiing with his family. The first time I ever went water skiing was because, like I said, I didn't take no for an answer, and my brother was going water skiing. I said, "I want to do it too," and I was just sitting in the speedboat. And Kenny said, "Well, why not? Of course you should do it." So he got an instructor on board. We went into the water, and Kenny was taking videos of me learning how to water ski.
That amazed me when I read that in your book, that a blind that you would dare to do that. It's amazing what a daredevil you were.
I was. I guess I didn't have any sense for mortality at that point, I suppose.
Yeah, because, I mean, even as a sighted person, I was always afraid to do that. I never even tried to water ski. That's amazing to me. Well, what do you think made you so? Do you think it's just your personality, or was it a nurturing environment and your parents encouraging you? Or do you think it's a combination of both that made you such a gregarious, daredevil kind of a person?
I think it was a combination of a lot of things. I had great parents. I had great teachers. I had some great teachers, actually, at the School for the Blind that I went to. And they really encouraged me to read. And they noticed that my reading levels were getting higher. And I just always had people in my corner noticing that I was able to do lots of things. Mm-hmm. And also, my parents sort of insisted that I be mainstreamed, too. And so there was never somebody telling me, "Oh, no, you're relegated to this part of society." I was always told that I deserve what everybody else deserves. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've just taken to heart. And when I was in middle school, I remember feeling for the first time that maybe people did want to relegate me to a certain part of society because they felt like I was sort of an alien. They didn't know how to relate to me. They didn't understand that I would go to movies and that I would do everything that everybody else did. So they didn't know how to relate to me. And so it was the first experience where I felt my self-esteem drop quite a few notches. And music, actually, at that point was what really helped. So I think music was another big thing that kept me going because it was something I was good at. Mm-hmm. And so when I was with other high school kids and middle school and high school kids that were good at singing, it didn't matter that I was blind. We all related because we were interested in classical music.
Yeah. I want to play an excerpt from your CD, Do You Dream in Color? This one is called Serenia. Can you tell us a little bit about it before we hear an excerpt?
Yeah. It's about a traveler on his way, and he's talking about wanting to woo this shepherd girl. And she doesn't accept his advances, but he's still very, he doesn't take no for an answer.
Let's listen to it.
Sure.
Por tierra fragosa, verdina carrera, novia.
Laurie, you have such a gorgeous voice. It's amazing. Did it take you a while to discover that you were a mezzo soprano?
Yeah, it did. Mm-hmm. It did, because it's almost like soprano until proven mezzo. But also, what the hard thing for people to tell me what I was is because I had a high extension to my voice. A lot of mezzos are very, they have deeper, you know, kind of a deeper resonance in their voices. So I always joke with people that I'm the mezzo without the balls. I have like the higher mezzo voice.
I've always liked the mezzo voices the best. Mm-hmm. To talk about the fact that you were really influenced by the musical Phantom of the Opera. So you also come from a, you know, a musical theater background and love of.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, my brother actually was a big theater person, and he actually went into theatrical PR because he actually was, he started as an actor. Hmm. And then he decided that you go to so many auditions in LA and you realize it's just really difficult out there. And he felt that his strength would be more in the business side of theaters. But at a very early age, I was going to Patti LuPone concerts and seeing musicals and Phantom. Before, this is when my brother was still in high school, we just went to see Phantom and we fell in love with it. I sat on the edge of my seat the whole time. You know, even though Phantom is a musical, mm-hmm. I really got into opera because the whole play is about 19th century opera. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny, you would think, well, Phantom would make me go more into musical theater, but I think also because most musical theater has a little bit more of a pop element to it, my voice naturally gravitated towards opera. It's just what I was better at. Mm-hmm. And
well, you made a good choice. You absolutely
made a good choice
on that one.
Oh,
yeah.
Thanks.
I want to talk about the fact that when you were in high school, you were accepted into the summer program at Tanglewood, the classical music training program. That seems to be kind of a turning point in your life. Can you talk to us a bit about it?
Oh, it definitely was. Because like I said, I'd had a really difficult time in middle school. And I needed that bolstering of self-esteem again. And when I went to Tanglewood, at first it was the same old thing where kids were afraid of me because they didn't know anything about me. And here I was, this alien who had no sight, and I had a talking watch and I had a talking computer. And, you know, it was just, I was different. But the moment I started singing, I remember I was singing an aria from Marriage of Figaro. We had a sing-through that we all had to sing arias so that they could place us in various voice types and whatever opera scenes they were going to give us. And the moment I started singing, people just started gravitating toward me because they realized you're human. If you can sing and you can do it well, you're not different than the rest of us. We're all here to sing, and that's when I started developing these deep friendships. And that was really important in my life. And the other thing that was so great about Tanglewood is you're rubbing elbows with people like Yo-Yo Ma and Yitzhak Perlman. And we were often in the same cafeteria as them.
Yeah.
And it was just such a reverent and yet just normal experience. It was just really neat as a high school kid to be exposed to that. I'll just never forget sitting on the lawn. We were watching the Carmina Burana done by the Boston Symphony, and they had a chorus, the Boston Symphony chorus. In the middle of the performance, this girl came up to us and said, "There are extra seats in the shed." And the shed is the main theater that you go into at Tanglewood. It's an outdoor theater. So she snuck us in to see the performance, and we were literally like maybe five rows from the front, and it was like pounding through us. And it was so magical. So I realized that music was going to take me on all these really cool adventures. And so Tanglewood is really the beginning of that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Laurie Rubin. She's a mezzo-soprano author, and she just recently released a memoir called Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. Now, talk to us about the fact that you actually ended up working with Joan Sutherland and the composer and conductor John Williams. I mean, both these people are so influential. That must have been an amazing experience.
Yeah, and actually, I just to start by saying, the other night we went to a benefit that John Williams was being honored at, and you know, I said hi to him after, and I thought maybe he'll remember, but he totally remembered, and he's like, "Oh yes, Knoxville summer of 1915. That was such an amazing experience," and it was so nice. He's just so genuine and so nice, and I said to him, because of course I'm the bold person that I am, I said, "So when are we working together again?" But it was incredible to work with him. I got a call from my voice teacher. It was just sometime late at night, and he gave me a call, and he said, "Listen, you know, I would like you to sing this solo piece by Samuel Barber with John Williams conducting." And he heard a bunch of singers' tapes, and he requested that you sing with him with the Oberlin Orchestra, because he had gotten an honorary degree from Oberlin. So we did this big performance at the Getty in L.A. They had flown the entire Oberlin Orchestra to this concert, and I was super nervous because I thought, you know, you're working with this conductor. He was going to be so reverent and maybe scary, but no, it was like going out to meet my uncle. You know, he was just so nice and
yeah,
so kind.
You say that in the book. Well, what about Joan Sutherland? Didn't she teach you something about putting more drama into your singing when you were working with her?
Tell
us about that.
At that time, she had stopped singing. But she, every once in a while, she would just start singing under her breath, and it was almost like you felt like you were going back into one of her performances. It was really interesting and so exciting to be behind the scenes like that with her. But yes, the first day, we all sang our arias, and she said, "None of you have any sense of the interpretation of your songs," and we were all like, "Oh no," But she was just trying to get us to push us as artists to dig deeper, because you're not just singing an aria, you're embodying a character and owning a character. So she did teach us that, and it was just an incredible experience because she was on the major stages and doing it. And to hear from somebody of that caliber was eye-opening for me, I guess because I was only in my early 20s, my very early experience singing. So, she was unbelievable.
Now, I want to play another excerpt from Do You Dream in Color. This one's called Cantiga.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Sure. This song is about, he's talking about this beautiful maiden, and he says, I just challenge you. You tell me what's more beautiful than this maiden, the war, the sea, and it's just a beautiful, pure song.
Yeah, let's listen to it. These are just beautiful pieces, Lori. I was just knocked out when I first heard your CD. It's amazing. Talk to us about how you feel about color. You've talked about it in interviews and articles. You associate it with smells and tastes. Tell us about it.
Well, color, from a blind person's perspective, I think to me it's certainly more abstract because my eyes have never actually encountered it, but I've always felt that I had a sense of color, and I think it's because I've had perfect pitch, so each note to me has a different personality and a different color, and so I can hear color in that way. Also, the fact that we can taste and smell and feel different things that have totally different textures and tastes and auras to them, I think that's really helped me get a sense of color. And then over the years, I always joke, you listen to the Today Show enough and you listen to the fashion experts and, you hear that blue is going with camel or, it's just you get to know what colors go well together. And so I start to have these very poetic images of color and, what they remind me of in terms of life experience. And that's really why my book, I've made a point of weaving colors in with certain chapters because I wanted people to know that color is more than what the eyeball sees. It's actually what you experience in your life. I think that when you smell something, and I think this happens for a sighted person too, it brings you back to a certain time, and I think that maybe certain colors are our favorites because it makes us think of certain things. And so I don't feel as a blind person that I've lost out on that at all. And in fact, I've made jewelry, and I love putting on makeup, and all these things that you would assume that blind person wouldn't care about. And actually, there are some blind people I know who really don't care about that. So, you know, I think we're all different. But color, to me, is very important.
Yeah, well, you said in one interview that you sense that color comes from a past life. You know, so your
yeah.
sense of color comes from a past life. Do you really think that?
You know, I say that in jest, but, you know, I it's a whole conversation that, you know, I still have, you know, with people and, you know, thoughts I have in my own head. You know, it's hard to know because sometimes I feel when people say the word blue, immediately images come to my mind about blue. And for some reason, I think of the G major or the, if you're a real classical music geek like me, the Mixolydian mode, for some reason, I think of that as blue. When I think of B-flat, I think of chocolate. So yeah, I mean, the funny thing is, I can't even tell you what I'm seeing in my head, but I do feel like I'm seeing color. It's weird.
Well, then you are seeing color, absolutely. Tell us how do you make jewelry? I know it says on your resume that you also make jewelry and even sell it. Mm-hmm. How do you make jewelry?
Well, I took a class with, she was the person at the Jewish Community Center who was teaching classes, and I asked her to be my private instructor for the technique part, like the wire wrapping, and she showed me how to, with her hands on my hands, how to use the tools, eventually so that would become a kinesthetic motion when I was doing certain things. And eventually I just would go to bead stores, and this kind of relates to what we were just talking about color, is that mm-hmm. I would ask very specific questions. I'd say, is this a lighter turquoise, or is this sort of more of a teal? Does this turquoise veer towards the green, or is it more blue? And I would always take note of that in my head. And I never had to really write things down, because I just, whenever I would touch that stone, that color that they described to me would just come to mind. Right now I'm wearing a pair of earrings that are teal, and I'm just thinking about the process of making them, these teal glass beads on the bottom. And I thought, well, you know, I remember people telling me that turquoise goes with brown. And since this is a more green teal, I decided to use a little bit of opposing color, and I put a little bit of copper, a tiny bit of copper, and a little bit like a light yellowish brown, almost an amber-colored crystal, and some dark brown so that the teal would really pop.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's absolutely amazing. You know,
oh, thank you.
I also want to talk to you about this. You know, in addition to some of your challenges as a person without sight, you also discovered when you were young that you were a lesbian. And, how have you dealt with that issue? Have you become an activist at all?
You know, it's so interesting. For some reason, the whole being gay thing hasn't bothered me nearly as much as the blindness. And I think maybe because I dealt with a lot of misconceptions about it from a very early age, whereas I grew up around gay people. And so even though I know that there's certainly a lot of hatred and gay bashing, and, you know, I think just having that strength in numbers has really made me feel better about myself in that way when I came out. Definitely, I do feel like I need to be active about that, and that's why, you know, I've taken a lot of interviews with gay magazines, and I'm always open and excited to do events with gay youth. And, you know, whenever I teach somebody who's gay, it's wonderful, because I just feel really good about being able to share with them and make them feel better too from my own life experience. And then the final thing that I felt like I did as a more of an activist was that when Proposition 8 was passed so soon after this wonderful victory for gay people, I was very, very upset. And I didn't take it personally, but I was angry. My partner and I, we were both upset, and we had with some friends of ours, who a lot of them happened to be gay, we had a chamber music ensemble in New York. Not only did we do concerts, we tried to have a socio-political element to all of them. And we did this one called Love Has No Bounds. So what we did is we had gay and lesbian composers, and we did a scene from a very recently written lesbian opera called Patience and Sarah, which is a mm-hmm. 19th century love story. And we brought this into St. Mark's Church, and we had this great concert, and we gave all the proceeds to the Hedrick Martin Institute, which for a lot of people, I'm sure your listeners, some of them know that it's a program that nurture and have resources for those who are struggling as gay, lesbian, transgender, and questioning youth, and who deal with a lot of homelessness for kids who are left out on the streets because their parents are not willing to accept them as gay people. Mm. And the funny thing is, well, they're like, well, Proposition 8, why would you give your money to the Hedrick Martin Institute? What's the link? And I said, well, it's because some of the people who decided to vote for Proposition 8 were saying, we have to protect the children.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, well, what about the gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgender children out there? You're not protecting them. You're only going to protect the straight children. So that's why we gave the money to that organization.
Well, that's great, Lori. That's wonderful.
Thanks.
Now you live in Hawaii with your partner, and you started this performing arts festival in school called Ohana. Tell us a little bit about it.
Ah, yes, Ohana Arts. Well, the wonderful thing is that Hawaii is rich with culture and a very appreciative audience for all kinds of music out there. And Hawaii does not have a professional theater per se, or I should say Oahu, because that's where we live. But the community theaters tend to be really, really good because of that, and because people are really wanting to see good productions. And unless you get something like Wicked that goes on a national tour, we have these wonderful community theaters. So there is a thriving community, but unfortunately, the symphony has been struggling and hasn't gotten back on its feet after the unfortunate situation of it kind of being run into the ground a few years ago. And so what we wanted to do is really build on the rich culture in Hawaii and to bring back a classical music scene. And we also wanted to bring more of an educational and performing arts element back into Hawaii, because my partner was telling me that when she was in high school, she got a full scholarship to Interlochen, and she was only the only one in the state her year that got this scholarship. And she went to Interlochen, is this wonderful international performing arts camp, so she was with kids her own age who were incredible at their field in the arts and working with incredible teachers and then uniting, basically, to celebrate their love of the arts. And she said, you know what, people in Hawaii don't have that access to it. And, you know, a lot of them financially can't afford to these exorbitantly expensive programs and also the flights to the mainland.
So you decided to start this.
Wow. Exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
Amazing.
So we're in our fourth season. We're going to be doing Footloose this summer. And right now we're working with mostly local youth, and we have a musical theater program. We have a composer-performer workshop for high school advanced instrumentalists. And we will keep growing and maybe eventually have a youth orchestra. We'll have a visual arts program. And eventually what we want to just do is make this an international gathering place, so that you'll have Tanglewood, you'll have Interlochen, Aspen, and Ohana Arts in Hawaii.
Oh, that's great, Lori. Well, listen, we're almost out of time.
Sure.
Can you give us some contact information and how people can get in touch with you and maybe get a hold of your book or your CD?
Absolutely. Well, my book is available on Barnes & Noble and Amazon and all of those websites. You just have to look for Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. And also the CD that you played is there. That's just called Do You Dream in Color? And my website is just Lori, Laurie, -rubin.com. There's a blog, and I have all sorts of things, you know, my calendar of events and all of that. So I'm hoping that I would be able to let people know in your area when I'm going to be around.
No, that's great. Well, Lori Rubin, you are such an inspiration to people. I just commend you for all the work you've done in the world, and I hope you keep it up. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
Yes, good luck in the future. And again, this was Lori Rubin, mezzo-soprano and author, and the book is called Do You Dream in Color? Insights from a Girl Without Sight. Thank you so much, Lori.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.